You are listening to The Tish with Rabbi Michael Knopf, a JCast Network podcast. For more information about Rabbi Michael Knopf, please visit mikeknopf.com. For more information about other JCast Network podcasts and blogs, please visit jcastnetwork.org.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
We are on a new subject as of last week. The objective is to work through various mitzvot, various commandments, and to consider what their reason for existence might be. Why those are the commandments? What are they supposed to do? In Rabbi Irwin Kula's language, what's the job that they're trying to get done? In the language of the medieval sages, what are the ta'amim? What are the rationales for those commandments? We talked a lot last week about the sort of abstract theory of all this, that a good God would not capriciously give commandments, that there was, even if it might be difficult to ascertain, some purpose for each and every one of the commandments in the Torah. And so we started last week looking at just a little bit from the preface of Sefer HaChinuch, which is the main text we're going to be looking at. Sefer HaChinuch is a mid-13th century text written anonymously. There's some various theories about who wrote it, probably written in Barcelona, or as they say, Barcelona. And a book that really seeks to go one by one through each of the 613 commandments, and talk not only about what's involved in performing that commandment, which is helpful, very kind of concise overview of what's involved in performing that commandment, but I think more interestingly, a rationale or an attempt to come to a rationale for each and every one. But he also has a sense of an overarching rationale for the entire Torah. And that's what I want to look at today, before we get into any individual commandment, because we have a sense of what his belief is of the overarching rationale for the entire Torah. You can use that lens, apply that lens to each and every commandment. His rationale, I think, is not a bad one. It's not necessarily the one that I would have come up with, or that maybe you would have come up with, but let's see what he says, and then let's see what you have to say. So turn to page 62. Okay, it's on one of the other side of the handout, 62-63, I'll read in the English, although you can see that that the original is not English. Okay, so for now, I'm toward the bottom of the page. For now, God created in God's world discarnate spirits of intelligence, the angels. Intelligence here in philosophical language is synonymous with soul, right? Spirit, right? So you have a split in Platonic philosophy between idea and matter, between body and soul, between physicality and mind, right? So the words intelligence, mind, soul, spirit, these are all interchangeable words in medieval philosophy. And so when it says God created discarnate spirits of intelligence, that's actually, the Hebrew is a little bit more graceful than that. Schalim nivdalim, separate intelligence, or disembodied intelligence would be a better word, right? Like Casper the Friendly Ghost. That's the angels. And God equally created spirits of intelligence in enduring physical form. Depends on your glass half full or half empty, slightly lower forms of pure spirit. This is how the medieval philosophers in a pre-scientific world considered the heavenly spheres, the planets, the sun, the moon, the stars, things like that, were not physical objects in the same way that the Earth is. They were more incorporeal than that. But that's not a little bit neither here. That's a little bit ancillary to the objective here. These being the heavens and all their host. Okay. Then he created on earth physical creatures without any intelligence. These being beasts and birds and the other species like them. All right. Now I'm going to just have you, if you can, put aside your scientific minds in here. What he's saying here is not necessarily valid in a post-scientific world. We know that animals and birds and other species, while they may not have consciousness on the level of human beings, which may be what he means, consciousness, mindfulness, or that's actually more of a loaded term, the ability to mind. Right, as a verb, animals may not have that, but animals certainly have intelligence, right? Thought processes, and in some ways, the difference between the rest of the animal kingdom and human beings is a difference of degree more than kind. But in any event, he is suggesting that that animals have no intelligence, animals have no spirit, animals have no mind. So God created those purely physical creatures, right? And then he also probably would argue non-animals, right? The rest of the what we would call the natural world, right? You know, trees, plants, shrubbery, right? Rocks, right? Matter that has no mind. Then God created on earth physical beings with intelligence. Okay, so there's another category, sort of in between. This is the general idea that human beings are a little bit lower than angels and a little bit above beasts. Right? We have a body, we have physicality, but we also have spirit, we also have mind, we also have consciousness. Right? All to let it be known that nothing is beyond God. For even though matter and intelligence are total opposites, right? It's a polar opposites in this view between body and spirit. We shouldn't be able to have both of those things simultaneously. Nevertheless, God merged them into one by God's great wisdom and thereby made man. In all events, it would be inevitable that this intelligence merged with matter, i.e. man, should know his maker and acknowledge him in order to complete the divine intention in creation. Okay, so what that means, I think, is that the purpose of a human being is to surpass his physicality and enable himself to or herself to focus more on mind, on spirit, to in other words, come closer to God or the godliness that each of us have. And in that sense, that's what I think he means by knowing God. By refining and directing our intelligence in a way that enables us to transcend our physicality, right? So the purpose of being human is to know God. Now, if not for the Torah that God gave him, man's intelligence would be completely drawn after his material nature with all its cravings. He would be like the beasts that perish, and thus the work of his creation would not be completed. For then the human body and the animal body would be one and the same practically, though they are not the same in form and purpose. In other words, if a person doesn't do this work of trying to overcome the temptations of his body in order to focus on the needs of his mind, of his spirit, to refine it and get it closer to its naturally divine state, then a person would be just like any other animal. And what the Torah is striving to do, according to the author of Sefer HaChinuch, what the Torah is striving to do is help a person overcome his animal drives, right, overcome his physicality or her physicality, and be able to know, focus more, come closer to God. That's the objective of Torah. To overcome the limitations of our physicality, to overcome the temptations of our physicality, and to know God more. That's what those two things are what the Torah is trying to do, according to Sefer HaChinuch. And then he gets into a thing on the next page about, well, if that's the case, if it's for human beings to strive in that way, then why is it only given to Jews? Ralph asked this question last week. His answer is not one that I'm particularly fond of or proud of, but nevertheless, you can see it there. Basically, what he says is that not every field in the world is ripe for planting and for growing crops. So too, not every group of people is ripe for this kind of important guidance that God gives human beings in order to reach to that level. It's essentially a racialist argument, right? That God recognized that the Jews have the best capacity among all the other peoples to fulfill this sacred mission of becoming the ideal human being that is more intelligence than body.
That doesn't make sense.
Go ahead. I agree.
How can we say that God didn't make Goyim as bright as Jews? How can we say that?
Well, just want to be fair, we are not saying that. Author of Sefer HaChinuch said that.
To say it makes no sense at all.
Yeah.
I mean, and I just can't understand that.
Can I go back a paragraph? Because I'm troubled by I accept that it's an idea for a reason to have given Torah.
Mm-hmm.
To be an ability to use your mind and not just your surroundings. But when you read Torah, it's essentially a series of laws or narrative related to those laws, so you're capable of living on your own in a land. I'm not sure how right. I see he makes one follow the other.
I think it's part of, you have to take historical context.
Well, I understand.
Truly, 13th century, the way the rest of the world was behaving, they were behaving like animals. When you think about
it. This is in Spain.
Visigoths and.
Right. So you're right.
It's a frightening world that those folks were living in.
You're right, although to be fair, 13th century Spain was much more advanced and enlightened than the rest of Europe at the time, but that's a fair point. And I think, I guess, to your point, put in its historical context, this is not maybe a good argument today, but I think it's fair in their historical context that that Muslims would have made the exact same argument about Islam, Christians would have made the exact same argument about Christianity, about how there's sort of a natural predisposition among certain groups of people to know truth or to be able to receive truth. Fortunately, we've come to a place in society where we don't think that way anymore. But what's forced upon the Jewish people is to rethink this notion of chosenness. What does it mean to be chosen if we also believe that we're not inherently better than other people? All men are created equal. Okay, well, if that's true, then how can the Jews be the chosen people?
Right.
Right. So that's a tough one.
It is tough. And I've always been, I think our people has been heard more frequently than any other people that I know of. And yet we are the chosen people. And the reason that we have had that much trouble is because we have been telling the rest of the world that we're the chosen people.
It certainly is one of the reasons. And I think that, you know, to be fair to the author author of Sefer HaChinuch, he might say that that, you know, he might read it the other way, which is that that the Jews are persecuted in order to for them to realize that what matters is not their physical cravings, right? So, you know, you live in bad conditions, in a hostile environment, in order to, you get kicked out of your land, right? All these things are helpful for the Jews. I don't know if he says that directly, but I don't remember him saying that directly anywhere. But it sort of follows from the logic. Going to Lou's point, I think what he would say about, and we'll see some of them, what he would say about many of the laws in the Torah that are about establishing community, establishing government, agricultural laws,
wants
things
water.
Like that.
That'll be fine.
I think what he would say is that there are certain social conditions that help make the work of knowing God more likely, more possible. Right, and so it, when the Torah sets up social norms and governmental rules, right, what it's trying to do is create those conditions. And then if you get into some of them individually, right, some of the agricultural laws, for example, whatever, he might, I think he would say that that, you know, what we're doing is not. What we're doing is being conscious in
really
those various acts, right? So we're not just scarfing down whatever food we find, right? We're thinking carefully about where it came from, who created it. We're ignoring in some way our animalistic drives, you know, I think similar with the establishment of governments. There's something inherently human and not animal about the act of establishing government. But what kind of society, what kind of government you establish, I think is it depends on whether you're establishing it in order for the for the fulfillment of certain animal. Are you establishing society so that you can eat more food?
Let me try and state my thought. This kind of view of Torah and God really gets away from a covenantal relationship. In my mind, it certainly gets away from any sense of partnership in the relationship.
Why do you say that?
Because this is trying to define it by your intellect, not by your relationship with God.
So how would you phrase a rationale for the commandments in a more covenantal...
I mean, in its purest form, we've accepted God, and God has given us the Torah.
But why specifically that Torah? Why specifically those commandments? Right, assuming that in a relationship, God could have given us any commandments, right? And also, by the way, in that relationship, what are our, you know, if it's truly covenantal, right, what are our commandments for God?
You know, but that, I said on Sunday, Hammurabi had a code of law that was something that was ahead of Moses, ahead of the Mosaic Code.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still talking about ourselves as being chosen. Where is Hammurabi's status in the world, in history? Was he the chosen people too?
Well, apparently not.
I don't know enough about Hammurabi to know whether or not. My guess is that he would have considered himself a chosen king, and he would have considered his people people.
You would admit, would you not, that Hammurabi's code, which preceded the Mosaic Code. You would admit that, wouldn't you?
I certainly would, but I'm not sure if an author in the 13th century would have.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if he knew what Hammurabi's code was. for the, you know, this is a in some ways a the conception of history among medievals was very different than our conception of history. So they didn't. This is before biblical scholarship. This is before archaeology, right? He didn't know of Hammurabi, I'm sure, and he assumed that the Torah is literal history, and tells the entire story of human history. So he doesn't have any reason to believe that it's not true. other than that, there are other truth claims out there. And so one of the things that he's trying to do, and the argument he makes about the Jewish people's chosenness is similar to the argument made in the Kuzari by Yehuda Halevi, which makes an argument for why Judaism is a more reasonable, rational religion than Islam, Christianity, or philosophy. And so he makes a similar kind of argument. So in some senses, he is sort of fighting against other truth claims. But that's the best he's doing. He's not acknowledging things that he has no idea about. Charlie?
He does acknowledge the Noahide laws.
Yes,
he refers to them.
Yes, he does.
And so it's like the Noahide, those laws are for everybody.
Right. Right.
But we have additional laws.
We have additional laws. Right, and so what he does say is that that the rest of humanity has the capacity to achieve what Jews have to achieve, and they have a way of doing it. It's just different than the way. So I think that there's actually I think that's a redeeming feature of his position. And if you wanted to, and this is certainly not what he meant, but I think you could flip it. You could make an argument saying, like, listen, the non-Jews only have 7 laws. We have 613. Clearly, they're closer to their non-animal self than the Jews are, because the Jews have to have all these other commandments in order to transcend their animalistic urges. And so, anyway, that's not certainly not what he's saying. I'm not sure that's what I would say, but I think that you could say it. Yeah.
Well, maybe this just oversimplifies it, but, I mean, for me, chosenness is not that we're better necessarily. We're chosen. We've agreed to accept 613 laws of the Torah. So, which other people signed up for that? I'm not saying that everyone who's Jewish does it, but which other people signed up for it? I don't think anyone. I mean, that's the whole notion of chosenness. I mean, they said other people signed up for something else with their religions, but it's not. They didn't sign up for the Torah exactly.
Right. So chosenness is about choosingness. So the question I would have then is what we signed up for the only right way? Right. So because chosenness, at least in this context, seems to imply that even if we're the ones doing the choosing, that what we chose was substantially better than the other options that are out there, right? It's like the part of what I'm hearing in you is the Midrash that talks about God, you know, shopping the Torah around to all the other nations, and every nation asks, you know, what's in it, and God says, you know, thou shalt not steal, and they're like, whoa, 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 right? Thou shalt not murder, hold it right there, right? And then God finally comes to the Jews last and says, will you take the Torah? And they say, nah, seven ishma. Right. Okay. That's.
But historically, that's not true.
I agree with you. It's a lovely thought. To me, it's a much more lovely thought if what you also are prepared to say is that that the Torah that God was offering all those other nations is not the only true path to salvation.
That is an answer for Hammurabi. You know, there was another version out there.
Yeah.
Something.
Right. Wasn't the only code, right?
As a matter of fact, it preceded the Mosaic Code in many ways.
We only know that now.
Yeah, but the
fact we know that from reading the footnotes in Eitz Chaim.
Right. They certainly didn't know that in the 13th century.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so this is the premise that we're working with, though, for Sefer HaChinuch, that the objective of Torah is to get people to be closer to their spiritual selves and to understand God more. Right, that's close to what Maimonides said in the Guide of the Perplexed, where he said that the objective of all the commandments is one of two things. He says it's a perfection of the body or perfection of the spirit. This is closer to perfection of the spirit, which is what Maimonides meant is a clarification of a philosophical truth. Right? And for Maimonides, the person who was closest to God was the best philosopher. Moses was the best not only the best prophet, but the best philosopher. And the reason he was such a good prophet was because he was a good philosopher. Right? And that, I think, is close to what Sefer HaChinuch is saying, too. But he's, I think, going... the other direction, also perfection of the body, means a sense of being more than just an animal, right? Being more than just someone who has, you know, physical appetites and drives and acts on them all the time. Perfection of the body means being a conscious, embodied creature.
So, during this period of Sphera, mm-hmm. as I understand it, every week has an attribute associated, and then every day another attribute, and they're paired. Mm-hmm. And one of the attributes is Gvura, which mm-hmm. is discipline.
Right, which is last week's attribute.
Right, last week's. And so what I attribute that to is kind of what you're talking about, the physicality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It really applies. Whereas, you know, there are things where that kind of discipline or structure, moderation, however you want to say, has both a physical and a spiritual context.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I'll let you have the last words. It's a really beautiful process. Yeah. Have a great day, everyone.